You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It's been a terrific day, but we saved the best for last. And we're honored to have Tony Blinken, Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama, with us. Those of you who've been with us all day, and I think that's most of you, know that we have covered the region pretty well and pretty deeply, but we're now going to focus on the administration's kind of inside view of where we stand in this effort against ISIS and to bring a greater degree of order to the region. I think everybody knows Mr. Blinken's distinguished resume. He was Vice President Biden's National Security Advisor before becoming President's deputy, and before that, the Democratic Staff Director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're really honored to have you and looking forward to hearing from you. He has a tight schedule. It won't surprise anybody to know, but we will try, after hearing from him, to get some good questions in from all of you.
Great. Jessica,
thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon. It's wonderful to be here, and it's especially wonderful to be here on an extraordinary day for Carnegie.
Yes.
And let me just start by saying, and I presumably echoing what others have said, which is, first of all, Jessica, your leadership of this institution for, I believe, 18 years has been extraordinary. You've turned Carnegie into a global institution.
Thank you.
And at the very forefront of all of the think tanks in Washington and indeed around the world. And it's also hard to imagine finding someone to succeed Jessica in this job, but I think Carnegie's pulled off a brilliant coup in getting Bill Burns, the former Deputy Secretary of State, to succeed Jessica. Those of you who know Bill, and that's probably most people in this audience and beyond, know him to be an absolutely extraordinary leader, someone who brings incredible intellect, wisdom, and decency to everything he does. And I can only say that Carnegie will be transitioning into very, very good hands. I welcome this opportunity to spend a little bit of time walking you through the elements of our comprehensive strategy to degrade and ultimately defeat the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. I want to start, though, by trying to put ISIL in context. And indeed, I think it has to be understood in part, at least, as the product of a number of powerful regional trends, some of which I believe you discussed earlier today. First, the challenge to domestic order within states, the questioning of the status quo, the rise of new constituencies, the empowerment of new voices. That, in many ways, of course, has been a welcome development. But it's produced a violent counter-reaction from the old order, as, for example, in Syria, with its long death spiral of violence. And it has a dark flip side, the erosion of state authority, the emergence of ungoverned spaces, the proliferation of weapons and technology, the surfacing of sectarianism. The second big trend is the challenge to the regional order among states, the growth of sectarian rivalries, the intensification of the face-off between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the spread of dangerous proxy wars. Third, I think we've seen an intra-Sunni struggle between violent extremists and the vast majority of moderate Muslims, and a contest for leadership between establishment powers and political Islam, often represented by the Muslim Brotherhood. Fourth and finally, recent history, the recent history of Iraq. The lid has been lifted from decades of dictatorship, war, and foreign dominion, allowing many of these forces to collide head-on with the fragile beginnings of a more inclusive and representative governance. One of the most poisonous products of all of this churn has been the alienation from their respective governments of large segments of the Sunni population, some 20 million of whom live between Baghdad and Damascus. This is the vast sea in which ISIL swims, and it must inform the combination of determination, patience, and humility we bring to the task of defeating it. So how did we get here? Much has been written, much has been spoken about the relationship between our military departure from Iraq and the rise of ISIL. So permit me to spend a few minutes on a historic detour. As all of you know, in negotiating the 2008 Status of Forces Agreement, President Bush committed our forces to leave Iraq at the end of 2011. That commitment was premised on a simple, powerful idea that we were returning to Iraq its sovereignty. We shared that commitment. We also sought to leave behind a small residual force, a counterterrorism presence to help Iraqis develop intelligence and target AQI, the predecessor to ISIL, and an F-16 squadron to protect Iraq's airspace. As all of you know, the Council of Representatives would not give us the protection for our troops, the legal immunities that we sought. This was not as a result of a failure to negotiate. It's something we worked very hard. But what it is, and it needs to be understood this way, is really a leading indicator or a proxy for a much larger issue. Simply put, at that point in its history, after a 10-year quote-unquote occupation, the Iraqi body politic did not want us to stay in Iraq. That's what happened. We were also, to some extent, the victims of success. At that point in time, the ISF, the Iraqi security forces, were more numerous and capable. Iraqi leaders were more confident. And violence overall was down significantly from its peak in 2007-2008. At every step along the way of our very, very methodical disengagement militarily from Iraq, Iraqis did not believe we would actually leave and follow through. They didn't think that we would withdraw from the cities. We did. They didn't think we would end our combat mission. We did. They didn't think we would leave altogether with our military. We did. We had to demonstrate to them that we meant it. In effect, we had to leave in order to find a way back on the security side and gradually build up our engagement. It's a fair question to ask whether this modest residual force would have made a difference. And I think a fair answer that is in some ways yes, in some ways no. First, it would not have had a combat mission. So it would hardly have been in a place to repel ISIL. Indeed, it might well have been caught in the middle of everything that was going on. Iraqis would have placed severe restrictions on its activities and freedom of movement. And in any event, Syria became a huge and somewhat unanticipated accelerant to ISIL's rise. Second, it's also clear that the departure of our forces significantly decreased violence in the near term. Shiite militia stood down. Attacks against the U.S. embassy ceased. Some of you, I know, are veterans of trips to the embassy. And virtually on every trip prior to that point, you would have the great privilege of getting a mortar attack or a rocket attack. That ceased. And indeed, violent incidents in Iraq went down from about 1,600 a week at the end of 2007, early 2008, to 100 a week at that point. But it's also fair to say that had we been able to keep that small residual presence, that probably would have allowed us to better enable the Iraqis to deal with AQI and ultimately ISIL, and maybe helped us better shape Iraqi security policy. That's exactly why we sought to leave the limited residual force, and it's exactly why immediately upon the withdrawal of our combat forces, we tried to get our foot back in the door. The Iraqis in early 2012 told us they were confident they could handle the problem. We said, you're wrong. If you don't constantly and proactively go at AQI, they will rise up again. I had these conversations repeatedly with my Iraqi interlocutors, and so did many of our senior officials, including Vice President Biden. You need to keep AQI on its heels and off its toes. In early 2012, along with David Petraeus, who was then the head of the CIA, several of us sought an agreement to constitute with the Iraqis, in effect, a joint fusion cell in Iraq to help them target AQI. It's too soon, they said. Eventually, we'll get there. But you need to prove that you're not actually returning in force. Then the Arab League summit came around in March of 2012. We thought, why not provide the Iraqis with drones, intelligence drones, ISR, to safeguard the summit? They thought that was a great idea. They had Arab leaders coming in from around the region. It represented a real security challenge. And they welcomed this possibility. And we thought this is a good way to get our foot back in the door and to help develop more intelligence against AQI. Unfortunately, the story leaked to the press, and it became a political hot potato, and ultimately the Iraqis said no. So there was an exercise in frustration throughout 2012 as we sought to work our way back in. All of that began to change in 2013. AQI became ISIL, fueled by the conflict in Syria. In Iraq, in early 2012, at the time that we left, there were about 5 suicide bombers a month. By early 2013, it was up to 50 a month, and this was the hallmark of AQI and then ISIL, which, by the way, was not initially predominantly an indigenous force in Iraq. It was mostly, at that point, a foreign force. Iraqis suddenly became much more open to, and indeed desirous of aid, but quietly. In the spring of 2013, we began a systematic effort to ramp up our counterterrorism assistance to the Iraqis. We used the Foreign Military Sales Program to try and get to them more Apaches, F-16s, missiles, small arms, and ammunition. This, of course, required working with our Congress. And there was a certain amount of reluctance, which was not hard to understand, because of concerns about the leadership of Prime Minister Maliki. We resumed, in very small numbers, ISR flights in late 2013. We stood up a targeting cell in 2013, and that helped the Iraqis capture about 200 ISIL fighters. And we put in a small number at our embassy, a small number of special operators and CT trainers. Throughout the year, and then well into 2013 and then to the beginning of 2014, the committee that I chair, the deputies committee, met more than a dozen times on the question of increasing support to Iraq to deal with AQI and then ISIL. The principals committee, the National Security Council, met multiple times on the same issue. It was something with which we were deeply engaged. When President Obama met with Prime Minister Maliki in November 2013, ISIL was at the top of the agenda. The president told the prime minister, you need a comprehensive approach to this problem. There's a military piece to it. We're working hard to help you with it, but it has to be comprehensive. And in particular, you have to pursue political reforms to address the legitimate grievances of Iraqis who otherwise might see ISIL as a savior. 2 months later, ISIL streamed into Ramadi and Fallujah, with the ISF laying siege. In short, we were focused and acting on ISIL and the threat that it posed more than a year before the fall of Mosul. But the problem began to outrun the solution, fueled by the conflict in Syria, Iraqi reluctance, and a renewed sectarianism in Iraq in advance of its elections, with politicians on all sides playing to their bases. That brings us to almost the present, to this summer, with the fall of Mosul and the erasure of the border between Iraq and Syria. When that happened, the president acted decisively as well as deliberately. Our immediate focus was on protecting Americans. We rapidly deployed military personnel to further secure our embassy and the international airport. We put in more ISR to develop a clearer picture of what was happening on the ground. And we sent in small military teams to assess the viability of the Iraqi security forces and the status of the threat. Then, as all of you know, we initiated limited military action to protect U.S. personnel, protect strategic sites, and prevent large-scale humanitarian catastrophes. Those initial airstrikes stopped the ISIL advance on Erbil. It allowed the Iraqis to control the Mosul and Haditha dams. Air power helped provide relief to thousands of Iraqis trapped on Sinjar Mountain and in the town of Amerli, and to break the ISIL siege of both of those places. These actions also had the benefit of blunting ISIL's momentum, buying time and space to put in place pillars of a comprehensive strategy to roll back ISIL. The first pillar is a new, inclusive Iraqi government. We put particular emphasis on its formation, and indeed, we leveraged the promise of greater U.S. assistance accordingly, because we could not expect Iraqi Kurds or Sunnis or the various neighboring states to join forces to counter ISIL with an Iraqi government pursuing a blatantly sectarian agenda. Indeed, we resisted more expansive military effort until change was well in train, lest we be perceived as the air force of the outgoing Prime Minister, Mr. Maliki, perpetuating his hold on power, alienating Sunnis in Iraq and in the region. Instead, we focused our initial diplomacy on creating conditions for Maliki to step aside and completing government formation in record time. Now, we have a government committed to reforming the military, giving us a more effective Iraqi partner, and addressing the legitimate grievances of the Sunnis, and so dilute their support for or acquiescence to ISIL. And I'll come back to that at the end. The second pillar that the president wanted to have in place before embarking fully on the comprehensive strategy was a broad regional and international coalition. We were very deliberate in building that coalition before taking sustained action. We could not make it look like the United States was acting against ISIL or Islam or the Christian West was opposed to the Muslim Middle East. That's just what ISIL would have wanted. Instead, we kept the focus on a global challenge in which regional states, which had the most immediately at stake, played leading roles. Now, more than 60 countries around the world have signed on to this coalition. And when we took our first airstrikes in Syria, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, Bahrain, and Qatar flew with us. With these pillars and partners coming into place, we began to implement the comprehensive strategy to go from blunting ISIL's advances to starting to roll it back. The objective, and the president's been very clear about it, is to disrupt, degrade, and ultimately defeat ISIL so that it no longer poses a threat to Iraq or Syria, to our people, partners, or interests in the region, or ultimately to the United States itself. The defeat of ISIL will not happen easily. It will not happen quickly. It will not happen through exclusively military means or by U.S. efforts alone. To the contrary, to succeed, our strategy had to be comprehensive, broad-based, and it must be sustained. So, in concert with our coalition partners, we are leveraging all elements of our national power in four basic ways. First, we're working to destroy, starting with degrading it and then ultimately destroying ISIL's warfighting capacity, its command and control, its leadership, its supply lines, its logistics, its ability to mass force and overrun local populations. And we're doing that through a combination of military and counterterrorism means. Second, we're working to uproot its central nervous system. The financing, the foreign fighters, the religious legitimacy, and the recruitment that are its lifeblood. And we're doing that by bringing to bear intelligence platforms and sharing, national and international laws, cooperation among enforcement officials, sanctions, counter-legitimacy campaigns, enhanced transportation security, increased efforts to counter violent extremism within partner countries, and indeed here in the United States. Third, we're working to dilute local support or accommodation to ISIL through tribal engagement, pressing for the resolution of legitimate grievances, regional diplomacy, shifting momentum against ISIL on the ground, and squeezing the space within which it operates. And finally, we're working to build partner capacity so that local forces can take the fight to ISIL and retake the ground that's been lost through train, advise, and assist programs, through the provision of weapons, ammunition, and equipment, and through direct military action to enable partner success. The people we are helping will do the fighting on the ground to retake their countries. The strategy recognizes that the situation we face in Syria is more complex even than the one we face in Iraq. Unlike in Baghdad, where we have a viable local partner and ground forces to leverage, Assad remains in Damascus, a magnet for the extremism that we seek to defeat. For more than 2 years, working with and supporting the moderate opposition, we've made some gains in making it more effective and trying to position it as a counterweight to Assad. Now, we're intensifying that support, including through an overt train and equip program under so-called Title 10, which the Saudis and Turks have offered to host. This will give the moderate opposition more effective tools to help them and us counter ISIL, to protect its own communities, and over time, to demonstrate to Assad and his patrons that he will not prevail militarily, creating the conditions for a negotiated settlement. This train and equip program is not a silver bullet. It's going to take time to train recruits and produce results. The forces arrayed against the moderate opposition are powerful. The Syrian army, backed by Hezbollah and Iran and Russia, on the one hand, ISIL, Nusra, and other extremist groups, battle-hardened extremist groups, on the other. But the program's critical to eventual success. The coalition can do real damage to ISIL through the air. But without forces on the ground to hold territory from which ISIL has been removed, we will not be able to shrink and eventually eliminate the safe haven. Meanwhile, we are taking action every day to degrade ISIL's capacity to project power into Iraq, to resource and sustain its forces. We're going at its command and control, its headquarters, its training centers, its arms depots, its oil refineries. And to cite just one example, we're seeing significant results. Take, for example, the oil refineries, storage tanks, pump stations. The International Energy Agency reported just this past week that it's clearly affecting ISIL's ability to fuel its vehicles and derive revenue from the sales of diesel and gasoline. Let me conclude with this. I spent about a week in Iraq a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to give you a report card on what I found, because I think it's illustrative of both the challenges we face, but also some of the promise that is before us in terms of success. First, if you look at the political situation, Iraqis are dealing now with a legacy of mistrust, of suspicion, of grievance. And they also face an incredibly difficult economic situation. Oil prices are down. War and expenditures on internally displaced persons are up. Investment is on the fence. This makes for a very complicated situation. But I was struck in meeting with virtually the entire senior Iraqi leadership across parties and ethnic groups in Baghdad and then up in Erbil and Duhok that there was a clear commitment and desire to work together across sectarian lines, a clear willingness to give the other the benefit of the doubt for now. And the reason was simple. Virtually every group in Iraq has been looking into the abyss, and they've seen what is before it if they don't manage to work together to take on ISIL. We've already seen the Prime Minister Abadi say and do significant things in terms of reaching out to other communities. He disbanded the infamous Office of the Commander-in-Chief, which was an office that his predecessor, Prime Minister Maliki, had established to have the military report directly to the Prime Minister's office. He removed some of the more difficult and challenging generals. He pushed through, at some political expense, a Sunni defense minister, a post that had been vacant for 4 years. And he is now pressing, with pretty much the entire body politic, for the creation of a National Guard that offers the best prospect of bringing Sunnis into the fight, and I'll come back to that at the very end. And he's leaning forward and engaging the Kurds on oil revenues and back pay for the Peshmerga. And together, the Iraqi political leadership is trying to advance a national program that can address the interests, desires, and grievances of all the communities. So there is promise there. They're off to a good start, but it's against the backdrop of significant challenge. Then there's the military piece. And the Iraqis face two very significant deficits. First, the previous prime minister had, in effect, hollowed out big chunks of the Iraqi military. He deprofessionalized it, moving out some of the competent leadership, moving in people loyal to him who didn't necessarily know what they were doing. He cut the normal chain of command and made sure, as I mentioned a moment ago, that some of the senior leadership reported directly to his office. But that's not any way to run a war. And, of course, the force itself became more sectarian in nature. And so when you had the Iraqi military deployed into Anbar, a predominantly Shia force deployed into a Sunni region, despite the fact that it was there to help the communities protect themselves against ISIL, it was working in a community that didn't trust it, and it asked itself what it was doing there. And then it ended up being cut off from its supply lines, isolated, without effective leadership. And that's been going on since January of this year. And that's the very difficult situation we inherited in Anbar. But we've also seen something very positive. When the efforts of the Iraqi security forces are planned and coordinated with the coalition backing them, they can be very effective. And the same thing for the Kurdish Peshmerga. We've seen that, as I noted before, at the Mosul and Haditha dams. We saw it outside of Erbil. We've seen it more recently at the Rabia border crossing and in Amaria. And as we speak, we're seeing it in Zumar in the north, where the Peshmerga have retaken the town, and we're seeing it as we speak in Beji, where the Iraqi security forces are moving to take the area around the oil refinery that Iraqi forces have held very valiantly since June. So what this means is this, and this is our approach. We are working with the Iraqis to establish a campaign plan that is planned, coordinated, and methodical to begin over the next months to take back, site by site, town by town, territory that has been lost to ISIL. At the same time, and this is where you have to do some building of the plane at 60,000 feet, we did an assessment of the Iraqi security forces, and we found that about half of the forces we were able to inspect, in effect, were not competent. Now, the glass half full version of that is that half of the forces were, so there's a good foundation to work with. But the Iraqis are engaged in a significant retraining effort. About six brigades are in retraining. And the coalition, in the weeks and months ahead, will begin to take part in that effort. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there's the National Guard. Iraqis are bought into this concept. It's a way to bring local forces in to protect their own communities, but have them tethered to the state, which provides the equipment and the salaries. This is a very significant development. The challenge, of course, is it will take time to stand up. And so what we're working on now with the Iraqis is, in effect, a bridge to get to that National Guard so that we can take advantage now of the increasingly significant number of tribes who want to get in on the fight against ISIL, who recognize that their future is better off with Iraq than with ISIL, but who need help, who need supplies, who need equipment, who need support. As the Iraqis and the Peshmerga in the north go on the offensive, as they move from their heels to their toes, this has very beneficial impacts. First, it changes the dynamic. It demonstrates that ISIL is not 10 feet tall, that it's not invincible. One of the reasons so many foreign fighters have flooded to Iraq and to Syria is precisely because of this perception that ISIL has the momentum. It's the place to be. It's a winner. As you start to go on the offensive and put them on the defensive, that dynamic changes. Second, ISIL has changed some of its tactics since our initial military strikes. In many places, it is not massing its forces. It's moving around in smaller groups. It's taken refuge in cities and in buildings. It's even taken down its infamous black flag so as to be less visible. As the campaign begins and as the Iraqis start piece by piece to go at them, ISIL will have to make a choice. It will have to stand and fight and so be very visible to the coalition and our air power. It will have to flee, or it will hunker down, and instead of the Iraqis being sieged by ISIL, ISIL will be under siege from the Iraqis. As we're doing this, we're aggressively working the other lines of effort I mentioned before, internationally, around the world, to stem the flow of foreign fighters, to interrupt the financing, to undermine the legitimacy, and to deal with the humanitarian challenge. So, having reviewed what the strategy is, let me conclude with a very brief word about what it is not. It is not Iraq or Afghanistan redux. It will not involve deploying tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of American troops. It will not involve the expenditure of trillions of American dollars. It will not require the United States to go it virtually alone. The Iraqis don't need, and indeed they don't want, foreign forces in combat in Iraq. As the Prime Minister said on national television just last night, that would be divisive, it would distract from the mission, and indeed it would also probably endanger our own forces. And more to the point, we will not fall into the trap that ISIL would want to set of drawing us in large numbers, bogging us down, and bleeding us. That's exactly what they want, and that's exactly what we will not do. For these reasons, too, we believe the strategy that we have, while difficult, challenging, time-consuming, is sustainable, and ultimately will be successful. Thank you.
Would you prefer to pick?
No, I'm happy
me to.
Do?
If I may, let me just then start with the first question, which has to do with administration has managed to put together, as you mentioned, an extraordinarily broad coalition, more than 60 countries, but that encompasses a number of different, even conflicting agendas. What do you see as the biggest challenge for maintaining the integrity and the coherence of the coalition, and as you know, in the months immediately ahead, and how are you going to manage to keep it together?
Thanks, Jessica. Well, I think what's extraordinary in the first instance is the fact that countries that came to this with incredibly disparate agendas, often in conflict with one another, actually came together to join this coalition and to work against its many lines of effort. And that is evidence of the fact that for all of the differences among the coalition countries, their minds are concentrated by the wolf at the door, and that's ISIL. And so there's a glue that's keeping this together, and it's a common interest in degrading and ultimately defeating ISIL. There's no doubt, though, that you're right, that there are differences among the coalition members. In Syria, a number of coalition members would like to see the focus placed more on removing Assad. There are tensions that can arise in terms of the composition of coalition members who are taking military action and what sensitivities that may touch in different countries. But I have to tell you, by and large, what we're seeing now is rather extraordinary cohesion. And what we've done is put in place a structure and a model that puts a tremendous emphasis on keeping the coalition together and strengthening it as we go forward. As I think virtually everyone knows, the president asked retired General John Allen to lead the effort to work day in, day out on building and sustaining the coalition. And of course, against the different lines of effort, military, financing, foreign fighters, legitimacy, etc. We have lead agencies in the government working with their counterparts to do the same thing. And John Allen, his deputy, Brett McGurk, who's one of our most experienced hands in Iraq, are on the road virtually full-time, making sure that they're working to keep us together. And, of course, the president has played a lead role in this as well. He convened an extraordinary summit at the United Nations of leaders from dozens and dozens of countries to get greater commitments to deal with the problem of foreign fighters. And we've seen real success and progress there. And he's burning up the phone lines every day as is the vice president. So bottom line is, at least till now, there's been remarkable cohesion. There will be tensions going forward as different countries have put a different emphasis on different parts of the agenda. But again, my sense is that the common denominator of wanting and needing to deal with the ISIL problem will keep this together.
Thank you. Mike. Ed. Mike. Here you go.
Michael Gordon, New York Times.
Michael.
Tony, the U.S. has used air power to protect the Kurdish population in Kobani and to protect Kurds and Yazidis and Turkmen in Iraq from the Islamic State. But the United States has not used air power to protect Sunni Arab opponents of the Assad regime against barrel bombs and other attacks. And as you know, this is a distinction that has not gone unnoticed by the moderate Sunni, moderate Syrian opposition. How does the United States hope to recruit and maintain the support and sustain the morale of the moderate Syrian opposition and eventually use it as a ground element in the effort to contain the Islamic State, as you noted in your speech, while at the same time taking the stance that it's not prepared to protect them against airstrikes, unlike these other groups? And under what circumstances would the U.S. be prepared to use air power to protect them? Are you really going to take the better part of a year, $500 million, to train and equip moderate Syrian opposition and then put it in Syria where it'll be vulnerable to the regime's airstrikes? Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. First, I think actually we have been using air power in ways that advance clearly the interests and agenda of the Sunni population as well as other populations. For example, we've taken action in Anbar around the Mosul and Haditha dams, which are strategic sites for the Iraqi government, but also go to protecting Sunnis who live there. We have worked hard as well to, as I said, start to build out two things. First, this National Guard, which will be a way to bring Sunnis into the fight, to have them engaged with the state, and that will benefit as well from the full support of the coalition. We're working on building a bridge to that guard as it develops. And in Syria, we have focused initially on working to degrade ISIL's capacity to project power, including and in particular into Iraq. So we've tried to focus on making sure that we were looking at the strategic assets that it had, command and control, headquarters, oil refineries, arms depots, training centers, et cetera. And we've been very deliberate about that. We've also tried, when we've seen significant humanitarian catastrophes in the making, to take action. We did that in Amerli, we did that on Sinjar, and we've done that in Kobani. But here's the challenge, and I think this is important. As I said earlier, there is a very methodical campaign plan that is in development, and indeed we're starting to roll out on. And we have to stick to the plan. Unfortunately, every day, there is going to be, in some part of Iraq or some part of Syria, a community that is under siege, under attack, and is looking for help. We can't be every place, every time. We have to stick to the methodical plan to start to roll back ISIL in a very deliberate way. That's what we're doing. If we get moved off of that plan by something popping up in one place or another, we're not going to succeed. So we're trying to be disciplined about this. We're trying to help the Iraqis be disciplined about it. But the bottom line is this. ISIL represents a threat, first and foremost, actually to the Sunni community in Iraq as well as in Syria. We've seen the conditions under which Sunnis are living in towns that have been taken over by ISIL. We get the reports. We know what the living conditions are like. And for the vast majority of people, this is not the future they want. The Iraqi government has to demonstrate to them that they're better off with Iraq than with ISIL. We're making good progress on that, hence the political dimension. And we also have to support them more, especially the tribes, in terms of allowing them to get more fully into the fight with training, equipment, salaries, etc. All of that is happening. Again, the coalition is, 5 or 6 weeks old? So we have to have a little bit of strategic patience as we build the strategy.
Fred.
Thank you very much. Fred Wary with the Carnegie Endowment. If I could follow up on this National Guard plan, I mean, some have hailed it as a second awakening, but there's a lot of details that remain unclear. What do you see as the risks of this plan to Iraqi cohesion? This tether that you mentioned, how strong is that? What are the mechanisms in place to strengthen that tether? And I guess the broader question is, how do we strike a balance between devolving security to the local level, empowering communities, and not encouraging fragmentation, warlordism, and militia rule?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, and it's a challenge. But I think what we're looking at is a few things. First, empowering local communities to, in effect, defend themselves is, I think, a very powerful potential mechanism. And the National Guard, its members would be drawn from local communities. It would be tethered to local leadership and to the governor of a province. It would probably act at a provincial level and be commanded and controlled at a provincial level. But unlike the awakening, it would actually be directly tethered to the Iraqi state as well, which would provide for its salaries, its equipment, its basic sustainment. That gives you, I think, the best of both worlds. It creates an entity that answers to and is supported by the state, but its membership is drawn from local communities, and people will feel a lot better about having their own protect them. Closer in, you're likely to have local police forces. Think of this in a sense in terms of circles. The local police force closest in, at the local level, at the town level, at the city level, the guard at the provincial level, and then the Iraqi security forces, the National Army, at the national level. But like any National Guard, this guard would could be federalized in an emergency situation. So I think there's tremendous promise there. Now, you're right, there are complications. One is, what do you do with the Shiite militia? Will they be folded in themselves to a guard? Will they be folded in to the Iraqi security forces? We saw early on that these militia were probably critical to helping the Iraqi security forces hold on in the early days when they were under tremendous strain. But they also represent a real challenge because, to understate things, they're not exactly popular in Sunni communities. So those militia have to be either drawn back and disbanded, or their members need to be integrated into official security forces. And then finally, the Peshmerga. They will have no doubt an interest and certainly desire to remain as independent as possible. How does that fold into a guard concept? So all of these things we're working on. Again, standing it up is going to take some time. It's at the top of the agenda of the government, but it has to be legislated. That's going to take a little bit of time. In the meantime, what we're trying to do, as I said before, is work with the Iraqis to take advantage of the fact that we're already seeing tribes starting to move from being either with ISIL or on the fence to being with the government, but they need assistance now. And so bridging to the point when we get to a guard is what we're working on.
Gentleman right here.
Thank you very much. Tolga Tanis, Hurriyet. I had a quick question as a follow-up to Dr. Matthew's question, actually, in terms of this coalition building with different priorities, and especially the role of Turkey. I know the official rhetoric, and when an American official is asked about the role of Turkey in this coalition, you always say that Turkey has a role in this coalition in a different ways, and the Ankara government is aware of the threat imposed by the ISIL. But when you look at the situation on the ground, there are major differences between the two sides, even between two NATO allies. After airdrops, especially, the President Erdogan criticized the U.S. government very harshly in terms of this PYD as an offshoot of PKK accepted by the Ankara government, but it's not the case for U.S., for example. Or Ankara sees Assad as a priority, but ISIS is a priority for U.S. Mm-hmm. Even in Incirlik, President Erdogan recently said that we don't know even exactly what Ankara is Washington is expecting from us on Incirlik. Can you give us a better sense in terms of the bilateral relations between U.S. and Turkey in terms of?
Sure. Thank you very much. Turkey is an absolutely critical and essential part of this coalition. It's already playing a very significant role. As I alluded to earlier, it's offered to host a training site for the Syrian moderate opposition that will benefit from this train and equip program. That's a critical contribution. It is playing a critical role in trying to deal with the flow of foreign fighters, many of whom transit across the Turkish border, and we're in very close collaboration on that. Same thing with the foreign financing, to the extent that it is actually traversing borders. The Turks have taken a significant role in trying to crack down on that. And we're in ongoing conversations about other things they might do as part of the coalition. But as we speak right now, thanks to Turkey, there are Kurdish Peshmerga forces and Free Syrian Army forces moving into Kobani, thanks to a land bridge established by the Turks, again, bringing Peshmerga from the Iraqi Kurdish region and bringing in Free Syrian forces going through Turkey into Kobani. That, I think, certainly rebuts the premise that there's some conflict over the question of Kobani. The Turks have played a lead role in making this happen. And as a result, the reinforcements that are needed to help Kobani hold on are coming into place. So, again, Turkey's a close, close ally and a critical part of the coalition, and we see it every day.
Shell?
Michelle Dunn from the Carnegie Endowment. Some of the Arab members of the coalition against ISIL also have different definitions of terrorism, and some of them have either passed or are in the process now of passing new counterterrorism laws. Mm-hmm. There are some positive aspects to stop foreign fighters from going to Iraq and Syria, but then there are other aspects in which they would be criminalizing, or in some cases even counting as terrorism, things that the United States would normally consider to be free expression, peaceful expression of dissent, peaceful demonstrations, things like that. Are you concerned that this can lead to radicalization in those countries, support either for ISIL or for other extremist groups? And is this an issue that the United States is raising with the coalition partners?
The short answer is it's a constant part of our dialogue with a number of countries. Many face significant terrorism challenges, and it's important in answering those challenges to avoid actually taking segments of society that are not engaged in terrorism but may simply be critical of the government and actually incentivizing them to use violence as a means of advancing their agendas. So this is something that comes up on a regular basis. This has been something that's been part of the landscape for many years, and it's a fairly regular part of our dialogue with a number of countries. As I said earlier in addressing Jessica's question, I think what's very positive is that for all of the differences in definition and approach that we see and interests, the common interest of dealing with ISIL has been a very strong glue that has put this coalition together. But as we go forward, there will be differences of approach, differences of emphasis. The one you alluded to is certainly something that's there, and it's something that we talk about on a regular basis.
Let me be fair to the back. this gentleman right there. Go ahead. All right.
Go for it.
You go.
Thank you. My name is Saeed Erkat. I'm a Palestinian journalist in town, and I spent some time in Iraq, so I got to know it a little bit. My question to you on Iraq, with the National Guard, is it like awakening 201? Is it, or is it going to encompass all kinds of communities and different communities in the National Guard? And second, on Syria, aren't you doing the same thing basically because you and your allies are funding, equipping, and training and arming another Syrian opposition, while perhaps you ought to reconsider working with the people that are fighting ISIL, which is the Syrian army? You know, perhaps you can do some coordination. In reality, you know, we could talk about slogans all we want, but in reality, if you want to defeat them on the ground, you got to have ground forces, and the ground forces that are doing the work are the Syrians. Thank you.
Okay, Thanks. Maybe I'll just take one.
Sure.
Go ahead.
And Matar Ibrahim, former MP from Bahrain. You spoke about how U.S. administration leverages its power to promote inclusive government in Iraq. Do you have anything to leverage on the Gulf countries to go for pluralism? As you know, the Gulf countries are a major source for funding, for fighters, and for extremism. My question is specifically about what can you leverage? And if I'll go specifically about Bahrain, as you see, the going crackdown on human rights activists and political parties, what can you leverage on these issues?
Thank you. Let me take the last question first, and then I'll come back to the second one. And I think the last question harkens back to a question we heard earlier. Look, I think we've seen a pattern repeat itself in different places over and over again, and it's a challenge to break out of it. And that is that as countries that are facing very legitimate threats from extremist groups take action that is, in effect, much broader gauge than the threat, and as they potentially, in taking action, disenfranchise large segments of their own population from basic rights, they risk, in effect, precipitating exactly what they're trying to prevent, which is more extremism. And so we're, as I said earlier, we're in a constant dialogue with many of our partners in the region about dealing with the real threats that they face, but also trying to do it in a smart way that doesn't wind up alienating significant segments of the population who may find that they then have no choice but to turn to violence. And that's exactly what we want to avoid. So again, this is something that's a constant in our dialogue with a number of our friends and partners. With regard to the first question, first, is the National Guard the Awakening 2.0? As I said, I think it actually can be an improvement over the Awakening in that if the Iraqis get it right, it's clearly tethered to the state in a sustained way. And that creates a relationship between Baghdad and the National Guard forces where there is, in effect, both need each other and want to sustain the relationship. So if they get it right, I think it'll be a powerful thing that can actually be more effective and more sustainable than the Awakening proved to be. And finally, with regard to Syria, look, the problem that we face is that Assad has been a magnet for the very extremism we're fighting. That is what has attracted into Syria ISIL and various other extremist groups. We've long said that he's lost his legitimacy and that it's hard to see how Syria can be stable while he is Syria's leader. On the other hand, it's very critical that whatever happens in Syria going forward, that its basic institutions be preserved, including finding ways to preserve the basic military structures, institutions of the state, et cetera. We know what happens from our experience in Iraq over the last decade when you disband those institutions. It creates a vacuum, and that vacuum is usually filled by bad things. So going forward in Syria, I think one of the things that's going to be critical is getting to a political transition that preserves the institutions of the state and makes it clear to all of the different actors in Syria that their equities can actually be protected in a Syrian state. That's obviously a big challenge. I think we now have a new UN envoy who is focused on the diplomacy, Stefan de Mistura, and he's starting to make the rounds of the critical regional states. And we're very anxious to work with him to see if some of the diplomacy can be energized, because as people look out at the Syrian civil war part of this, I think all sides can see that ultimately this is going to exhaust them. It's already had the most horrific humanitarian consequences. And there's no military victory for anyone in the civil war. And the patrons of various parties who are spending millions and billions of dollars to sustain their proxies, that's a real cost too. So I think there should be a growing incentive to find a way forward with energized diplomacy to deal with the civil war. But part of that is the moderate opposition, building it up, making it a counterweight, and in effect further underscoring the fact that the Assad regime cannot win this militarily.
We have time just for one last crisp question.
Maha Kadura, I'm advisory board of Tufts and Fletcher. I was reading the book of the Dean of Fletcher, who was the Admiral Stravides.
Yes.
And it was really very interesting what he said about Syria, that I don't know if United States didn't up to the responsibility at the very beginning of the war, mm-hmm. either to really to strengthen the moderate opposition, because we'll face two situations. Either Bashar al-Assad will stay in power and will be more cruel to his people, or we'll see more extremism, opposition extremism. And then another article I read.
Be crisp. Can you
put what? And the other one, the Arab world is 70% the Muslim world, mm-hmm. and they are persecuted in Syria since 50 years. In Iraq, with the beginning of the war, they were, you know, with the dissolve of the army, Maliki, he built pure Shiite army trained by Iran. So they say sometimes ISIS, it is a reflection of frustration, which is terrible for, mm-hmm. you know, the Muslim world.
Okay.
But so how you see things?
Well, you know, one of the things that's so important to do is exactly what you've done, which is to try and put this into a larger context. And indeed, at the outset of my remarks, I was trying to put the rise of ISIL into at least part of that larger context. A big piece of that is the reemergence of sectarian division and violence, complicated in a place like Iraq by the fact that that had been held in check for decades as a result of dictatorship, as a result of war, as a result of foreign intervention. The lid was taken off, and in a miraculous kind of way, Iraq actually had and has representative institutions that you could argue function as well, if not better, than in certain neighboring countries. But the challenge of trying to build something like that when the lid's been taken off and when you have all of these other trends in the region that I described is immense. And so we're very cognizant of that, which is why I said we're approaching all of this with determination, patience, but also humility. It's a huge challenge. It's a long struggle. I'm absolutely convinced we will prevail in it, but it's going to take time.
Tony, I know you are on a tight schedule. You've been candid and informative and gracious, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.